Hello, I'm Tom Weber. Thanks for listening to NPR News here on the radio or online or on our podcast. We're continuing the conversations you've been hearing all morning here in response to the weekend's violence in Charlottesville. As you heard there just in the newscast, there were vigils across Minnesota over the weekend. More events planned to speak out against the white supremacists and neo-Nazi rallies that were held over the weekend that preceded that violent car ramming in which one woman was killed. As you heard in the newscast as well this morning, bail was denied just this morning for the man accused of driving that car who now faces murder charges. Your questions today, as you've listened here this morning through Carrie Miller's show and 1A and during Morning Edition, what else do you want to add to the conversation? What other questions do you have as well? 1-800-242-2828, 651-227-6000. You can tweet me at WeberTom1. And please don't call or text if you're driving. We're starting off with two guests here in the studio. Karen Moratz is Executive Director of Jewish Community Action. Karen, thanks so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Pastor Dwayne Davis is Senior Pastor at All God's Children Metropolitan Community Church in Minneapolis. He was one of the speakers last night at that vigil in Minneapolis. Pastor, thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Karen, I want to start with you, actually. We've had a lot of conversation on the air this morning through the hours here about the debates over the Confederate statues, for example, and the racism in this country and the history that we are dealing with. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that there was anti-Semitism as well that was part of this weekend. The initial event Friday night, in which you saw images of people with the torches walking through the University of Virginia campus, included chants, "You will not replace us," and "Jews will not replace us."
Yes.
What are you reflecting on here today as this conversation continues?
Well, thank you, Tom, for keeping us in this conversation. As you said, the chants were "Jews will not replace us." One of the posters that I saw on the Daily Stormer website for the rally that happened on Saturday was that this was a specific action to fight Jewish influence in the United States. So there was a very specific anti-Semitic message and intent behind what was happening there in Charlottesville.
And so what are you doing here on Monday? What are you thinking about?
Yeah, this is not new. You know, the Jewish community knows that anti-Semitism exists. There are multiple reasons why it's become more invisible to us. And I say, us, including myself on the left as activists. And it's real. It also serves a very specific function in making white supremacy work. And so anti-Semitism plays a very specific role in the oppression of people of color and indigenous people and other people experiencing oppression today. So I don't love seeing it because it's scary. It's scary for me. It's scary for my kids. And also, let's expose it and let's talk about the way it works.
What would you add, Pastor?
I would just say I'm so glad that Karen said it. And thank you for having me. Again, this is what I think got lost in the back and forth with the president and whether or not he said the right words, because what it's taking the attention off of, that this is what was on display, is a larger body of thought that's trying to rear its head. It's been there all along, but I was just telling Karen earlier that there were no sheets. There was no hiding it. There was no trying to avoid being seen. So this is a part of a larger issue. Let's not get caught up in the false equivalency of whether the president said this is on full display, something that's been there. It's broad, it's big, and I think in some sense they were advertising what they want to do.
So, I mean, one of the reactions to that is social media using that to say, well, now we can identify and call out people. And Bob Collins, my colleague, wrote this morning on the NewsCut blog that notes that Twitter identified one of the people, and he was interviewed for this newscast. He's from Fargo. His name is Peter Teft, and his father, Pierce Teft, wrote a letter to the editor that is online now for the forum, the Fargo Forum newspaper, where Pierce, his father, and Pierce, if you're listening, I'd love to talk to you. Give us a call, 1-800-242-2828. I, along with all of his siblings and his entire family, wish to loudly repudiate my son's vile, hateful, and racist rhetoric and actions. And then later on, Pierce says that his son once joked, "The thing about us fascists is it's not that we don't believe in freedom of speech. You can say whatever you want. We'll just throw you in an oven." And then Pierce concludes by saying, "Peter, you will have to shovel our bodies into the oven too. Please, son, renounce the hate, accept and love all."
And that's the kind of confrontation that I implored Minnesotans to take last night, that you have to. We're at a decision point now. Again, what happened in Charlottesville brought it out completely. There's no denying it. There's no more silence. There's no more looking on the way. You can't unsee it. You can't unknow it. And so just what that father did, and I know it's very painful. I know that must be the most painful thing he had to do, and to do so publicly. But this is a decision point for many of us who don't subscribe to those kinds of views. We have to confront families and friends and say, no, no, it is unacceptable. Something that we wanted our president to say. It is unacceptable. I know that's painful and scary. I told my congregation yesterday, I know that this is the most frightening thing if you have someone who subscribes to these beliefs. But this is a decision point for us now. There's no rationalizing or justifying it. If you really do want to stem the tide of this kind of hatred and violence, you have to say something about it and say it very clearly.
What do you add, Karen?
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. It is hard, you know, as somebody who's experiencing this from my perspective, it's hard to put myself in the place of having a lot at stake in calling this out.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
right.
For me, it's for me to say, hey, this is super racist, doesn't seem that controversial. Mm-hmm. And I know for some folks it is. And I think
because you've been doing it already, that it's kind of, there goes Karen again,
well,
that
I
kind
mean,
of a thing.
What does it cost me to say that these people that I'm trying to distance myself myself from any, I mean, it doesn't cost me anything to say this is really hateful and a bad thing.
Right.
And it's hard for me to put myself in the place of folks who will feel they will
lose
something.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And I understand those people are there. And I would just ask for them to access that part of their humanity that watches this and feels sick.
Yes.
The Daily Progress is the name of the local newspaper in Charlottesville. And if you follow at Daily Progress, they are tweeting out articles and they're following this story really magnificently. I really hope you give a hat tip there to the local journalism in Charlottesville. They just tweeted out one of their photographers who has a photo of the memorial in Charlottesville, who has this caption that a man walking past the memorial for the Charlottesville victims, I'm reading this off Twitter, patted his young son on the head and said, quote, when you get older, you're going to learn about all of this. Pastor Davis, I'm trying to get a sense of that. Where does this event fit into what has been a very eventful few years? Where do you think this falls?
Well, again, in some sense, I think this is the byproduct of our refusal to face up to something that we just has either refused to do or we've been silent about. This was going to happen no matter what. As a matter of fact, we saw some of it. We see it, these flashpoints that come up after the shooting of unarmed Black people. But because you can take a side, you can deny what we've always known. I mean, look at those monuments that we've been talking about. Every time we talk about those monuments and whether or not they should be brought down, no one, very few people, I should say, tell you when those monuments were placed there. They were not placed there right after the Civil War,
right,
or right after the South lost. What we fail to also think about in this history is that there was an intentional effort after the war to reframe and to own that history. And part of that was a willful mendacity that we've lived with for so long. So the reason I keep saying I think this is a decision point for us is because what those march, those alt-right white nationalists, neo-Nazis were telling us is that we are emboldened now. We don't have to hide behind anything. And so we are putting our stake in the ground here. We're going to show up and we're going to be violent. We're going to say these horrible things and we don't have to worry about it, or we don't have to worry about being presentable. So I think then that requires on our side an intentional effort to say these things. I said last night, we have to love the truth enough to start calling things by their proper names. I don't want to hear about this political correctness. I mean, that it's not politically correct to tell you what I saw in Charlottesville, the kind of hate I saw mm-hmm. there. That's what I saw. And so what Charlottesville to me, and what really just I've been struggling with is, how do we look at this decision point, get the courage, seize the moment, and then be intentional about standing against it?
It's also interesting that of the debate, and there have been a lot of conversations in Carrie's hour and during 1A last hour about the, specifically the Confederate era statues. I'm not actually going to dive that much into the statue debate because we've had a lot of that this morning, although I would note that the mayor of Lexington, Kentucky, said he had initiated plans to remove two statues there and said after Saturday he wants to actually speed that up. So it'll be interesting to measure what effect the demonstrations and the counter demonstrations have on that. As we talk here with Pastor Duane Davis from All God's Children Metropolitan Community Church in Minneapolis and Karen Moratz from Jewish Community Action. And we're taking your calls as well, 1-800-242-2828. Stan is in Austin. Hi, Stan. What are your thoughts here today?
Actually have some of the same stuff here. Am I on?
Yes. Yep. Go right ahead, okay. Stan.
Specifically, those two portraits that are in the Capitol, the Dakota and Ojibwe wanted them removed and gone. They were basically forced to accept having them relocated with a correcting, you know, historical correcting documents placed alongside it.
Right.
You know, obviously, few people are actually going to read it because they look at the picture and they walk on. And so we shouldn't take a holier, better than thou attitude here in Minnesota. Those, you know, like I say, and your program, Counter Stories, you know, the participants in that mentioned that they wanted those gone.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah, Stan, thanks so much. You got a lot of nods here in the studio when you said, especially the holier than thou thing about how this is not just a Charlottesville, Virginia story.
You know, I think when we talk about the paintings in the Capitol and we talk about these statues, you know, you hear a lot of response from the right that we need to – that this is history. You know, why should we ignore history? You know, we need to understand history. I think there's a lot of selective history remembering happening.
Right. That's right.
Let's go back to the phones here. Vance is in Aiken. Hi, Vance. Go right ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that I had seen, you know, the – these people have made these parades before, their rallies, and, you know, they have their flags, they do their salutes, whatever, but then they just go through and go home. They took the time to get the permits to express their views, and there's people that showed up wanting a fight. You know, they've seen people, they show up with masks, cover their faces, clubs. They taunted them, they crossed the lines, they threw stuff. You know, if they wanted to express their views, they should get a permit and have their own rally to show support, you know, for their views, instead of trying to interfere in other people's rights, is my point.
Vance, thanks so much for the call. I really appreciate it. Pastor Davis, what of that? I know that this dissects what happened in Virginia a little bit, but the idea that the bigger picture is, look, you know, you get a permit, even if you're the white supremacist group, just let them do it for an hour and everybody goes home. Why do the counter protest? Why risk something bigger like what happened in Charlottesville?
I'll respond in this way. Why not put that in sharp relief by standing against it? Here's what I mean. Again, that call is a typical call, what I call the false equivalencies, the justifications, the one that you say. Aren't there some views that we all hold that should say, you know what, sure, you have the right to you know, the free speech right to go and say what you want to say. But I want us to also understand that you don't have the right for me not to react or respond to your free speech. My free speech right gives me the right to come and say, you know what you're saying is unacceptable. And so for all the people who came there, and I noticed that gentleman and most of the other people who were talking about who given us the false equivalents, I noticed they did not mention all of those clergy people, some of my dear friends and colleagues who were out there and having to run from bottles and things and brass knuckles from the alt-right or the white nationalists. I noticed that they don't mention those peaceful clergy who are bearing witness to a way of community here. So I want us to be careful here because there should be, I was again telling Karen earlier, it should be easy. It should be easy for our elected officials and our president to say, you know what? White nationalism and white supremacy and neo-Nazism, this sort of intentional hatred and bigotry on display, it is not what we support. And even if you support me, I want you to know this is not what I believe. That should be easy enough for our elected officials to be saying, and you know what? Citizens have the right to go into that public square and say, we don't want you to say that too. We don't believe that. Not in our name, not in our country's name, not in our city's name. We don't accept it.
You know, Karen, Carrie actually asked a really good question in the 9 o'clock hour with her guests about events like this happen. And yes, we're trying to contextualize and know where this fits in the larger narrative, but that events like this happen, we'll have the conversation the next day, maybe for the next week, and then it moves on. And where is the gumption? Where is the gumption to dive deep and really keep at it?
I mean, I think that's part of what I would say is my longer term goal is that I think, you know, rallies like this are scary, and rallies like this, it's easy for many of us to look at them and say this is white supremacy. It's somewhat harder to do a long term deep dive into undermining the systems and the policy that are part of white supremacy that we see every day. So, you know, it's one thing to say, well, this rally was hateful, and it's another thing to start picking apart the way that people of color are disproportionately represented in the criminal justice system. And I think, from my perspective, the way that happens is relationships. It's mm-hmm. building relationships, you know, within, like, in my community, doing the work within our own community, mm-hmm. and then building relationships across community with congregations like Duane's, with organizations that are people of color and indigenous people led, by getting into relationships, and then it creates some other level that keeps you sustained and staying in it for longer.
How well are the anti-Semitism efforts and the anti-racism efforts writ large, you know, Black Lives Matter and Jewish Community Action, how well are groups, I mean, are they together or are they doing their own thing? Should they be together?
I mean, I think they should be together. And specifically Jewish Community Action has a close relationship with Black Lives Matter, Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. I can't speak nationally. I can't speak in other cities. Here we have chosen to build power together. And I think that's really important. I think there's a lot of things that stand in the way. You know, anti-Semitism looks really different than other types of oppression. Right. It's often been used to function as a buffer to keep Jews, creating a protective barrier between oppressed groups and the ruling class. And it works. And we have to do the work in my community to bust through that and build those relationships.
And there are some organizations here in Minnesota that are doing that. I mean, both Karen and I sit on the Multi-Faith Anti-Racism Change and Healing Table, which is a group of churches and faith activists who come together to do anti-racism work. There is Isaiah, which really does a group of clergy that really address this issue. And one of the things I do want to say is that we are doing that work in our congregation. Just yesterday, we had planned it for many months, but we were going to be gathering to talk about how we were going to take our social action work to the next level. And it just so happened that the Charlottesville incident happened yesterday. I'm the pastor of a church that is majority white. And we had really good conversation and people willing to have that conversation. And that was my challenge, not only to my congregation, but to the people last night, that the next step is to go and confront all of these issues, all of the ways that these things show up. And that's what we should be doing next.
But what happens after that, right? What happens? Does the rallying cry of Remember Charlottesville become powerful enough that people in 4 or 5 months, when you're having a debate, to Karen's point about the criminal justice system, mm-hmm. if we then go to the Capitol and talk about mm-hmm. whatever our prison population is, et cetera, when you have that conversation and you say, well, let's look what happened in Charlottesville, I get why philosophically people can draw that line, mm-hmm. but does it have that same emotional tie in 4 or 5 months whenever we're actually having the policy debate?
Right. Well, I think Karen said it right. I think that's where relationship come in. If we start having a conversation and we start developing relationships and we start understanding the kinds of systems and structures that have been in play for so very long, one of the things that I think will happen is the empathy choice will change. That's where I think we've been lacking. That's what I think we've been lacking with Jamar Clark and Philando Castillo. I think what we've been lacking in those conversations is that people have a choice, and they can exercise an empathy choice for people, or they don't have to. Mm-hmm. I think Charlottesville gives us an opportunity to begin to having conversations and relationship with people where when we start having this conversation 5 months from now, when I start talking to you about mass incarceration, when I start talking to you about poverty, when I start talking about the racial disparities in health, that empathy choice will be exercised because you trust and know me, and we've been having this conversation.
I want to jump in here for one moment and let you know that we're actually standing by. It is possible. We don't know of any timing, but it is possible President Trump, who is now back in Washington, might come out and make more comments about what happened in Charlottesville. And to the point earlier in the conversation with the criticism about the initial comments, we will see what happens with that. We will bring that to you. We don't know when it's going to happen, but I just want to let you know to stay tuned here with NPR News. I want to wrap up this conversation with Karen and Karen Marotz and Pastor Duane Davis with a call. I'm going to go to line 7. Michelle is in Washington, D.C., listening online. Hi, Michelle. What did you want to add here today?
Well, I actually wanted to call the question with both of the guests. Being an Episcopal priest myself, yesterday morning I had to start my church service by denouncing the Ku Klux Klan, white supremacists, and neo-Nazis, because my leader, who lives in my neighborhood, didn't do it. Calling out those questions becomes really complicated, not because I'm afraid my community is going to turn on me, but because I've seen online attacks leveled at people that I love a lot. And it's scary. And Karen sort of passed it off like, what's it cost me? And I think there's a deeper issue there for all of us to step up, and it's necessary to do, but there is a cost. And I'm wondering if Karen wanted to talk about that at all.
Sure. And I, hi, Michelle. I mean, I was attacked by Nazis on Twitter last year, who sent me memes and pictures of myself photoshopped into gas chambers.
Yeah, and you were ovened?
Yes, I was ovened, you know, and threatened. And it was a really dark few weeks. And so I was pretty flip when I said it doesn't cost me anything. It certainly has. And I think at the end of the day, the cost of not doing anything is greater when I think about the world that I need my kids to live in.
Is it continuing? Are you still getting memed? And
well, open? I mean, I run a Jewish organization, so I get a certain amount of like low-level neo-Nazi
right.
tweets.
But we saw Jewish community centers getting phone
yes.
threats earlier this year.
Yep, and my office was vandalized earlier this spring. But the personal attacks at me, I mean, we'll see what happens after today. But it's been pretty quiet.
Well,
it's okay.
We'll see. Final thought here, Pastor?
I do take her point in this sense that one of the things that I've said certainly about even what goes on in Minnesota, that there's a tendency for us to think that what goes on in a certain part of the city or a certain part of the country doesn't affect us, that we are not in some way impoverished by it. But I've often make the analogy to a house, that if you have a beautiful house, but there's one room that is just terrible and mm-hmm. smells funny, you don't have to have anybody visit it. People don't have to know it's there.
That's usually the son's bedroom, right?
You don't have to have anybody to visit. People don't have to know it's there. But the value and the quality of your life is diminished because mm-hmm. it's there. So if there's anything going on in your country or in your city that isn't right, that isn't healed, that isn't reconciled, you are that much more impoverished. So in that regard, when any people in your community, whether they be Native or African-American, people of color, they be Muslim, you are woefully impoverished when they are not affirmed and celebrated as a part of your community.
Pastor Duane Davis, thanks so much for being here today. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you, sir, for having me.
Karen Marotz from Jewish Community Action, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
I am joined by Tony McAleer, who is co-founder of a group called Life After Hate, which aims to work with people who want to leave white power or neo-Nazi groups. Tony himself is of that population. He was at one point an organizer with White Aryan Resistance, a skinhead recruiter, and did other tasks. I think he was in a band at one point as well, a white power band. And Tony joins me now, and I appreciate your time, Tony. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What are your thoughts here today after what happened over the weekend?
Well, it's tragic, and to be honest, it's not surprising. This seems to be an escalation of violence that, you know, I think we saw it at UC Berkeley battles between the alt-right and Antifa. I think it then moved to Portland, where there was numerous battles. And this isn't so much about Charlottesville. Charlottesville just happened to be the focal point at this time for these two sides to clash. And I think it was only a matter of time before it escalated to a violence where somebody was killed.
Taking your calls as well at 1-800-242-2828. Reggie is in Eagan. Hi, Reggie. What did you want to add to the conversation here today?
Yes, like the last caller, I'm not surprised about what happened. This country was founded on slavery, laws written in by the government for Jim Crow. After that, you had the school-to-prison pipeline system. It's not surprising at all. And then to force Donald Trump to call this out by name is an insult to injury, is an insult to the young lady who lost her life. And that's pretty much all I wanted to add to the conversation.
Reggie, I'm glad you called in. Thanks so much. Thanks so much for adding your thoughts there. Tony, I want to know more about your story and how you chose and chose to walk away from it and do this work here today. And I'm wondering if you could do that in the context, because the question I have to Reggie's point about just all of this bubbles up, how do you get from being someone who's part of the scenes we saw this weekend to being someone like you, Tony McAleer, who now rejects it all? What's that path like?
Well, I think to briefly understand how people get drawn into those movements to begin with, for me, I believe that the level to which we're willing to dehumanize another human being is a reflection of how internally disconnected and dehumanized we are. If we can't connect to and recognize the humanity within ourselves, we can't recognize it in others. And I was in a place where I was completely disconnected. You know, there was stuff that had happened in my childhood that I was really angry about. I was carrying around a lot of toxic shame, and I felt weak, powerless, and on the outside of things. And what this offered me was a sense of belonging, a sense of purpose, a sense of power that was very attractive and intoxicating for me as I was angry and the violence was an outlet. The number one reason or correlated factor in the history of someone joining a violent extremist group, and this is research done by the University of Maryland's START program, which is the study of terrorism and responses to terrorism, is childhood trauma. And I think when you've got this sort of toxic shame, when I ask people, what's the opposite to shame? And two words pop up over and over again. It's pride and honor. And you see these themes expressed by the white nationalist, white supremacist groups and ideologies. It's a hyper-expression of pride and a hyper sense to restore lost honor, which is really a reaction to the feeling of less than and that's down below. For me, what changed it for me was the birth of my children, my daughter and my son 15 months later. And what they did is provided me with a safe space in order to reconnect, in order to open up my heart, because I had shielded it and shut it down. I was so disconnected. And, children at that age, with their conditional love and compassion, it's safe to love a child. They're not going to reject you, shame you, hurt you, at least not till they're teenagers. And that allowed that thawing process to happen. The second piece was meeting a therapist for the first time who happened to be Jewish, and receiving compassion from someone who we feel we don't deserve it from is an incredibly powerful moment as well. And when I've listened to the stories of hundreds of formers, those two types of stories show up over and over and over again, because the antidote to shame is empathy and compassion, not more shame and hate.
And with this next question, Tony, we're armchair quarterbacking it a little, because all we can go on is what we've seen in the news reports, but from what you've gleaned and learned about the man who is now charged with second-degree murder in this case, bond was denied, by the way, this morning by the judge in Virginia, but from what you've learned of this man and his past, how does he either fit perfectly or fit not at all into what you just said about who joins these organizations?
I don't know too much about his past, but you know, being caught up in those ideologies, you know, that tells me something. And I think I don't know what his intentions were, whether he went there with the intention of mowing over and killing that Heather and injuring so many other people, or whether something happened and he panicked and hit the gas. I don't know what happened, but the bottom line is this ideology, if left unchecked, always ends up in murder every time. And whether he left Ohio with the intention of killing someone or not, that's what has happened, and he will pay the price for that, and so he should. But you know, it's important to remember that these are not just political ideologies. This always ends up in murder.
What about his age? I'm curious to know your thoughts on the age. He's 20 years old, and I'm wondering if you have a sense of whether there's a healthy new population of young people to carry
out the
white power mission.
Absolutely there is. And I think when you look at the young people, the millennials that are getting involved in the alt-right, there's those that are itching for a street fight. And I know what it's like to be on that white supremacist, neo-Nazi type group where you thrive on conflict. In fact, conflict is what feeds that beast. And I think it's important to confront these groups, but I think we need to do it peacefully, because the violence only emboldens them, energizes them, and gives them even further narrative with which to recruit. But to be that young man, I think millennials are facing, you know, the first generation that is not going to have not expected to have a better standard of living than their parents, and sort of facing a bleak future. They're looking for answers and someone to blame. And I think, you know, just like ISIS, these white nationalist groups are very adept at packaging a message that makes sense to some of these kids seeking an answer, and they're looking to blame others, and that's what these groups offer. They're vulnerable to that message, and I believe that there's a new factor involved. There's the skinheads and the thugs and that embrace the violence, but I think there's an online presence that isn't violent. I think they're a little more, you know, dare I say it, nerdy, a little more socially awkward, and they may have disdain for the violence of the skinheads and such. But they're just as violent, just their violence is more passive-aggressive and it's online. But they're just as angry and just as violent.
Tony McAleer with me, a former member of White Aryan Resistance, now a co-founder of Life After Hate, which aims to work with people who want to leave white power and neo-Nazi and alt-right groups. And when I spoke a few months ago with your colleague Christian Picciolini, a fellow co-founder of the organization, talked about his story. He grew up in Illinois, was a big leader in his white power group that he was a member of before he left. He also mentioned something you just did, Tony, that groups like this, like the white power groups, the alt-right groups, and ISIS, in many ways, groups like ISIS should be mentioned in the same sentence. Why?
Well, because violent extremism, I think, you know, if I back it up real quick, you know, we came together in 2011 as a non-for-profit, registered as a 501c3, and it was after going to the Summit Against Violent Extremism, where Google Ideas, which is now Jigsaw, held a summit in Dublin where they invited 50 former violent extremists from around the planet, as well as 30 victims and survivors, because it's critical to always include the voices of victims in these situations, and government and NGOs as well. And what happened there was, you know, they had the Ulster Volunteer Force and the IRA. They had FARC, Mujahideen, Red Brigade, you name it. The groups represented included some gang groups, but they transcended ideology, faith, gender, class, geography. And when we got down to hearing the stories of different people as to why they joined and why they left, they were so similar and so the same. So I think this is a human issue as to what the drivers are. The ideologies at the end may be different, but this is not ideologically driven. This is driven by a sense of purpose, a sense of belonging, and that type of thing. And it's driven by shame. And shame can be our own, how we feel about ourselves in terms of toxic shame from what's happened to us in our personal lives. But shame can be a collective shame. It can be from overt racism. It can be from Islamophobia. It can be from structural racism. It can be from misguided foreign policy and socioeconomic conditions. But shame is always the driver, and people that have a healthy sense of themselves and don't have that shame aren't attracted to these groups.
Let me get your thoughts on one other point here, Tony. I didn't mean to interrupt you there, but I had a question here from a caller in Duluth, not on the line anymore. But to this point, there's actually one of the news stories here this morning might be really interesting in terms of how this is addressed going forward. The internet domain company GoDaddy said that it is going to take down, it will not support the website of the Daily Stormer, which is a prominent neo-Nazi white supremacist website, saying that it violates GoDaddy's terms of service. Is that where we go? If all of this is online, do you go after the companies that host the websites and pressure them to no longer support those websites?
Well, I think what you'll find is there will always be someone who will support the website. And Der Stormer was, I think, removed because of comments they had made about Heather denigrating her as a person. And I think that, for them, crossed the line. I don't know that censorship is the answer. It doesn't, because I ran a phone line, a hate line in the 90s, and went to the Supreme Court of Canada twice over it. And the more the effort was to try and censor and shut down my phone line, the more it proved my narrative right, that the information I was trying to convey was so threatening that they had to shut it down. Censorship has a double-edged sword. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, most important is, I think we need to look at the division within this country. And I don't think we can afford to dehumanize anybody for any reason. And I expect the dehumanization happening from the alt-right. I expect that, and the violence happening from that. But I think in opposing them, we have to be careful not to dehumanize them as well, because as long as we dehumanize any human being for any reason, as long as we're prepared to do that, we can never have peace. And I think we have to look, I think we have to think outside the box. And I think it's up to individual actions of every person in every moment of every day to try and practice empathy and compassion. The most powerful moments that I've seen in the stories of formers is when people receive compassion from someone who they don't feel they deserve it from. And the hardest thing to do, particularly in a moment like this, is to have compassion for someone who has no compassion. And these people that are violent, displaying an ugly, divisive, and murderous ideology, they didn't come into the world that way. And what we've proven is that they're not stuck with that ideology for life either. There is a way to pull them back from that, but it's not with violence. It's not with naming and shaming. It's to realize that somewhere along the way that something's happened to divert them onto this path, and they can be diverted back off this path. And, you know, to quote, paraphrase Martin Luther King, darkness cannot drive out darkness. Only light can drive out darkness. And hatred cannot defeat hatred. Only love can defeat hatred. And I think we have to remember that as much as we may want to punch a Nazi in the face, that only emboldens them, feeds them, and makes it worse.
And that has also been happening as well. Tony McAleer, former organizer with White Aryan Nation, was a skinhead recruiter, left the movement, co-founder of Life After Hate, which works with people who want to leave white power and neo-Nazi groups. Tony, thanks so much for your thoughts and perspectives here today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
I also had that interview a few months ago with Tony's colleague, Christian Picciolini. That's available at nprnews.org. We're going to take you to the White House right now. President Trump has made a statement about Charlottesville. This is in addition or expanding on the comments he made Saturday that were criticized as not going far enough to condemn hate groups. So here's what the president said just a few moments ago.
Thank you. I'm in Washington today to meet with my economic team about trade policy and major tax cuts and reform. We are renegotiating trade deals and making them good for the American worker, and it's about time. Our economy is now strong. The stock market continues to hit record highs. Unemployment is at a 16-year low, and businesses are more optimistic than ever before. Companies are moving back to the United States and bringing many thousands of jobs with them. We have already created over 1 million jobs since I took office. We will be discussing economic issues in greater detail later this afternoon. But based on the events that took place over the weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, I would like to provide the nation with an update on the ongoing federal response to the horrific attack and violence that was witnessed by everyone. I just met with FBI Director Christopher Wray and Attorney General Jeff Sessions. The Department of Justice has opened a civil rights investigation into the deadly car attack that killed one innocent American and wounded 20 others. To anyone who acted criminally in this weekend's racist violence, you will be held fully accountable. Justice will be delivered. As I said on Saturday, we condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. It has no place in America. And as I have said many times before, no matter the color of our skin, we all live under the same laws. We all salute the same great flag. And we are all made by the same Almighty God. We must love each other, show affection for each other, and unite together in condemnation of hatred, bigotry, and violence. We must rediscover the bonds of love and loyalty that bring us together as Americans. Racism is evil, and those who cause violence in its name are criminals and thugs, including the KKK, neo-Nazis, white supremacists, and other hate groups that are repugnant to everything we hold dear as Americans. We are a nation founded on the truth that all of us are created equal. We are equal in the eyes of our Creator. We are equal under the law, and we are equal under our Constitution. Those who spread violence in the name of bigotry strike at the very core of America. 2 days ago, a young American woman, Heather Heyer, was tragically killed. Her death fills us with grief, and we send her family our thoughts, our prayers, and our love. We also mourn the two Virginia State Troopers who died in service to their community, their Commonwealth, and their country. Troopers Jay Cullen and Burke Bates exemplify the very best of America, and our hearts go out to their families, their friends, and every member of American law enforcement. These three fallen Americans embody the goodness and decency of our nation. In times such as these, America has always shown its true character, responding to hate with love, division with unity, and violence with an unwavering resolve for justice. As a candidate, I promise to restore law and order to our country, and our federal law enforcement agencies are following through on that pledge. We will spare no resource in fighting so that every American child can grow up free from violence and fear. We will defend and protect the sacred rights of all Americans, and we will work together so that every citizen in this blessed land is free to follow their dreams in their hearts and to express the love and joy in their souls. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless America. Thank you very much.
Mr. President.
President Trump not taking questions after that statement. Started off his statement with some remarks about the economy, some self-congratulatory remarks about the economy, moving then to condemn the KKK, neo-Nazis and white supremacists as criminals and thugs, saying racism is evil. Keith Mays, who's a professor for African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota, was listening to those comments and joins me now on the phone. Keith, what are your thoughts on what the president said, an update of his initial comments over the weekend?
Tom, I don't like it. There's something still about the president's statements. I don't like when he says, including the KKK and the neo-Nazis. There's something about that. He's still hedging on a severe condemnation or really an attempt that this moment has provided him as president of the United States to call out white supremacy for what it is. There's something about that that still doesn't sound right to me. Yes, it is a marked improvement from what he said over the weekend, but I'm still unsettled.
And the reason for today's comments, we saw the Daily Stormer, which I mentioned earlier, a neo-Nazi publication, said that Trump's initial comments, quote, were good. He didn't attack us. He just said the nation should come together. And so arguably he did attack them, but to Keith Mays's thoughts there, not enough in his mind. You're a history professor here, Keith. You reflect on this. You teach this. Now that we've heard the president's statement, bring this whole weekend together and tell me where you are right now in your thinking.
You know, well, I am very disappointed because it seems that we've taken a step back. We could see this coming during the campaign, and Donald Trump has a history going back even before the Birther movement. He has a history of pandering to the white right. And so it's not surprising that he would, you know, in many ways, encourage the extremists on the right to engage in this kind of activity. And who he surrounded himself with is actually an indication of, you know, how he thinks and what he believes. So I'm really discouraged by the last year in American politics in terms of where this country has gone. The only thing I can say now is that what is going to be the response by those in the country, mainly white people? People of color have in many ways trailblazed various movements around racial justice. And the question becomes, after a 50-year education campaign, if you want to go all the way back to the beginnings of the civil rights movement with Brown v. Board and what took place in the 60s, a 50-year educational campaign to essentially say to whites that racial injustice is wrong, and we need white Americans to stand up. And I'm glad that the counter protests are very multiracial. But the question becomes, what is going to be the response by other folks in the country who need to stand up with people of color and say that we're not going back to where we were?
Final thought here. William in St. Paul called and said racism is a conversation we're unwilling to talk about. So what form should the conversation take place? In our final minute here, Keith, what are your thoughts on that?
The conversation has to take place in every aspect, in every institution, in homes, in families. I had heard something over the weekend. I read something on Twitter that said that we don't want to see white people coming to black churches this Sunday to tell us how bad racism is, that they need to go into white spaces to have those conversations. And so it is high time that we as a country put this to bed once and for all, and it's going to take a collective effort on every American in this country to not only deal with racism, but other forms of xenophobia that continue to weigh this country down. And I think that there's an opportunity for President Trump to make a sea change in his administration, and so he has to lead on this, but we cannot wait on him. We will lead as a country. if he decides not to move in that regard.
Keith Mays teaches African American and African Studies at the University of Minnesota. Thanks so much for your thoughts here today. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.